Welcome to Scouts Out, an original science fiction story by A.A. Foringer, set in his Outfitters universe. All of the Outfitters universe stories are available in ebook format at smashwords.com. If you would like to support the author or read the story for yourself, please buy the book at smashwords.com.
Leo slid between the vegetation as softly as he could, keeping the muzzle of his weapon pointed forward. He fought the urge to wipe the sweat off his face. It would just reappear in a few minutes, so what was the point? He had only moved 50 meters from where he had hid the parachute, and already his uniform was soaked through with sweat. Ducking underneath a fern-type bush, he heard the whistle, and he knew what it was before it arrived. Artillery. Somehow, they had been detected. Instead of sending in troops to root them out of this jungle, the enemy had made the decision just to kill them with artillery. Leo hugged the ground, followed by another explosion, which caused tremors and the ground to quiver. No round landed particularly close, but it was enough to make Leo shudder. As dirt flew, trees were blown apart around him. Dirt coated him, and some flew in his mouth, which he quickly spit out. He laid there and wondered why him. What did he do to deserve this? He had not signed up for this. No one had asked him to join up. He had not been talked into this by a buddy who wanted to see the world, or in this case, the universe. No, he had been chosen, and woke up to this. Well, not this exactly. He had taken some steps himself, to end up lying here, face down, in this smelly, humid jungle. The shilling had moved away from his position, and he was about to get up and press on with the mission when he realized that something was crawling across his legs. Chapter 1. The final phase of this operation was almost complete. This fleet, and the selected ones, would be awakening soon. Then it would be on to the next species, and a little bit closer to home. The lessons learned would be categorized and retained for possible future use. The species had not been all that much different from the others they had dealt with before. A few differences in biology, sociology, and psychology. But they had been able to comprehend and overcome such differences with enough planning and patience. After the initial shock and confusion, the selected ones would make their choice. Then they would see whether or not they had been right in both their selection of the species and their training of them. The probability was in the positive range that the species would make the choice that they had been hoping for, to take the tools they had been given and attempt the task laid out before them. It was the most logical and emotionally correct thing to do, according to the studies. There would be a few of this species who would choose another path, but that was also expected and taken into account. Less than 1% would choose the less desirable direction, but that was the selected one's choice, and the Outfitters could not take away that choice any more than they could stop the universe from expanding, two bodies having attraction to each other. Their thoughts would not dwell on the ones chosen of the species they had outfitted, which is what they would give as their name, the Outfitters. More or less suitable for what they had done, and would continue to do as they move closer towards home.
The awakening was beginning.
Leo woke without a hangover, which was a miracle in his way of thinking, considering how much he had had to drink last night. Not that it had been in excess, but he did not drink very often, and when he did, he always seemed to have at least a good headache the next morning. Oh well, time to wake the machine. Leo reached over to his desk and flipped the switch on the power pack that his computer was hooked up to. As it began its slow starting hum, he got up and put on his robe. He walked around his room searching for clean clothes to wear and began to formulate his plan for the day. First, he wanted to review what he had to do on his term paper and work on putting his outline down. Then he was supposed to play some racquetball with Scott, who he hoped woke with a hangover because he had talked Leo into going out last night when he should have been home studying. Then make some plans with him to see what they were going to do this evening. All in all, a good plan for a Saturday. He opened the fridge and got out some chocolate donuts and a pint of milk. He placed these next to the computer, ignoring the sign that said no food or drinks. He had put up the sign himself for the benefit of his roommate. Leo looked at the screen, reached for his mouse, and brought up the word processing program. He got into that file that held his research paper. Just as he started to read the first line, there was a knock on the door. Leo checked the clock in the corner of the screen. 9:53. Too early for a lot of his friends to be up and around. Probably someone looking for his roommate. Or one of his dorm neighbors wanting to borrow something. Leo got up to open the door, putting on his glasses as he walked. At first, he thought the glasses were extremely dirty, Then he thought maybe somebody had switched his glasses because everything became blurry as soon as he put them on. He did not have any more time to think about it because he had reached the door and the knocking started again. Opening the door, he was greeted by a guy, about 45, in blue jeans and a green polo shirt, about 5'10", with short brown hair. "You won't be needing those glasses anymore, Leo," the guy said, extending his hand in a friendly manner. 10 minutes later, Leo knew the guy wasn't any friend of Dave's, or anyone else from his dorm for that matter. The guy was actually a very advanced form of a hologram created by the Outfitters to brief Leo and the 29,754 other potential members of the fleet that were awakening. The Outfitters had found in the study of the psychology of the species, they reacted more favorably to shocking information when it is given by one person who is non-threatening, which meant, in most cases, a slightly older member of the same sex in a familiar setting, allowing the person to mull over the information in private and deal with their new reality. This was the general rule for this species, but not one that was totally correct in all cases. But the Outfitters had not been able to do a deep psychological study of all the individuals from this species, just a mass survey. Therefore, they had chosen the most effective, efficient solution available to them. A short personal briefing from a friendly face, a familiar surrounding, was how the fleet would receive their initial briefings. The guy walked out of the room, and the door closed and locked with a final click. Leo just sat on his bed in disbelief, shock, and some horror. He thought he was handling the news very well, considering, after all, it wasn't every day a person woke up and was told they had been asleep for about 150 years. He wasn't on Earth anymore, and that a bloodthirsty, extraterrestrial fleet was headed towards Earth, and he was invited to join a fleet that had a 50-50 chance of stopping that invasion. Yeah, all in all, Leo thought he was handling the situation well, as he curled up in a ball and hoped it was all a dream. At the same time, Leo was trying to come to grips with the new circumstances he had been thrust into. The fleet was awakening. Not just the personnel, which was going from the highest rank to the lowest, but the ships themselves. Each ship had at least one positronic brain. The larger the ship, the more complex the computer brain. The first brain to awaken was the flagship, the most complex and temperamental. It would take the longest to finish all its steps of its startup process, flex its muscles to find its own boundaries. The smallest ships would start up last according to the schedule, going from largest to smallest. Any ship that traveled through hyperspace needed a positronic brain to compute the exact size, mass, and relative density of each ship, and the precise computations that were needed to bend the space in such a manner around the ship for it to enter into hyperspace. About an hour later, Leo got up from the fetal position and sat on the edge of his bed. It still didn't feel real, but the hologram had showed him enough to suspend his disbelief. The fact of his window dorm room, which had formerly held a view of a cold Pennsylvania morning, suddenly transformed into a large viewing screen through which he had been briefed on where he was and how he had gotten there. The hologram, named Bob, had told him that his computer contained the answers to any of the questions that he might have. As Leo turned to the desk and sat down, he looked around the room and recalled what Bob had told him about his life not having a substantial impact on the history of the world, and his influence being more important in this time and place than in any other time period. When Leo asked him if he could go back home and to the way things were, Bob explained he could not. This was due to the basic nature of time, the fact that it flowed in only one direction. There was a choice to be made. Leo could choose not to join the fleet and make his own way back to Earth, or anywhere else in the universe for that matter, or he could join the fleet. Leo needed to know more about the situation. He particularly needed to know how he fit into the whole scheme of things. Then maybe, just maybe, he would feel better. So as Bob had suggested, he turned on the computer and the large viewing screen for some answers. The Outfitters watched. So far, there were no anomalies in the reactions of the selected ones. Their behavior fell into the parameters expected. Shock, outrage, mourning, disbelief, fear, and even a few incidents of attempted violence on the holographic images, which resulted in a few things being broken in a safe habitat set up for the selected ones. The monitoring of the time flow of Earth had noticed no discernible ripples in the continuum, and therefore there were no need to put into action any of the safeguards. Chapter 2. Leo woke feeling achy all over. Weird dream, he thought to himself. Then he woke up fully when he realized it hadn't been a dream. The hologram, the way his eyes had been fixed so he didn't need glasses anymore, and the bathroom in what had previously been his roommate's closet, they were all real. Looking at his watch, he realized it was almost 11 o'clock. He had only an hour till his commanding officer showed. Lee says what the itinerary had said when he clicked on the new icon flashing on his computer screen. The computer, now that was a change. It had originally been a rather slow 286 computer with a tiny speaker that made very soft beeps and bong that he had bought from his uncle, who had used it for accounting purposes. Now Leo didn't even know what speed it was, but it responded to voice commands as well as keyboard and mouse prompts. And fast? Well, Leo could barely say the words before the computer would display all the information it had, enough to fill a library if the initial time Leo had spent on it had been correct. He had skimmed through Earth history in a little over an hour, learning about the wars, scientific advances, diseases, and other great events since he had been taken from the Earth by the Outfitters. Then he had gotten more specific, looking up his family, seeing what had become of them after he disappeared. The newspapers had stated that he had died in his sleep from an undiagnosed brain tumor. His obituary was not much, being only 21 at the time. Then he read his family's obituaries, but it didn't really faze him. Well, it did somewhat. But he didn't feel anything. He was numb. Everything felt unreal, artificial, and illusionary. Then he had studied where he was in the universe, and how far he was from home, and how long it would take him to get home. How to get back to Earth was the question that took the most time. This led to what type of spaceship he might be assigned to. And most importantly, why? Why was he here? Why had he been picked? Asking why led him to ask who had done this to him. The answer was the Outfitters, which was vague and didn't get much clearer the more he studied. This led him to study the Outfitters, whose creed scrolled across the bottom of each screen on his computer. Prepare, to equip, to allow the ones to choose. The information on his computer was limited, to say the least. To prepare, to get a species ready to protect itself from the horde that was heading towards their homeworld. To equip, to provide the species with a means to fight the horde. To allow the ones to choose. The ones were whichever species the Outfitters felt were threatened by the Horde, and allow them the free will to choose to decide whether or not to fight for their home world. The Outfitters' information further stated that they did not fight themselves. The last bit of information stated that to do so would be against their basic nature, thus they would stop being who they were. That was all the information provided by the Outfitters on themselves. Nothing on where they came from. Nothing on why they had developed this creed, or done any of these other things. After an hour of attempting to find different avenues of study to learn more about the Outfitters, Leo had moved on to the Horde. Leo had read once, a government was not only defined by what they did, but also by who their enemies were. What Leo found out about the Horde had made him become very devoted to the Outfitters. The Horde was an alliance of three different alien races. The Kalukans, the Stenotans, and the Illyrians. This did not include the races and worlds that were forced into slavery and heavy taxation by the Horde. Primary enemies that would, according to the Outfitters, attack Earth would be the Illyrians. The Illyrians were the originators of the collaboration that was the Horde. They brought the other two races together in one moving force. The Illyrians had developed star travel, and then had discovered and exploited the other two races. The Illyrians were directed by a guiding philosophy of good old-fashioned greed and lust for power, achieved by conquest, dictatorships, and a raping of a planet of its resources, whether they are animal, vegetable, or mineral. And unfortunately, the Horde, with all their nastiness, was expanding towards Earth, one solar system at a time. This naturally led him to a study where he was in comparison to Earth, which led his computer to put on a very interesting light show. Projected throughout his entire room was a three-dimensional star map, with the Earth being a small, blinking blue dot on the far end of his room, about midway between the floor and ceiling. Meanwhile, the position of the planet he was on was midway between the front wall and the back wall, and very close to the ceiling. Horde space was represented as a large red mass located where he was sitting and reaching out from the floor and halfway up the wall. Oddly shaped bulges, indentations along its border, and part of the Horde Empire seemed like a large tentacle reaching towards Earth. Getting up, he walked around the room, passing through star systems, and looking at the distances and trying to gauge just where he was. Asking questions, but not understanding the answers. The huge number of miles, the astronomical units of distance, meant absolutely nothing to Leo, so he figured out a way to make it relative to him. He asked how long it would take to get home. The answer? If a ship traveled at top speed and made no stops, it could reach Earth in 6 months. But after assessing the big picture, he moved on to where he fit into it, like what was expected of him, and what he would do in the fleet. The basic structure of the fleet was triangular, like most militaries, with one person in charge, an admiral in this case, and progressively more lesser commanders, till it came to the level of private. Leo was expected to assume the role of a junior captain in charge of a long-range reconnaissance ship. Studying more, he learned it was just one of 75 in the entire fleet. It seemed that the ships were designed to be the eyes and ears of the fleet, and to be able to move independently, always in advance of the fleet, scouting territory, mapping star systems and planets, exploring the surface of these planets, with the capability to enter and exit atmospheres, and even to operate underwater if necessary. The ship was also able to be an effective fighting force for the fleet, if need should arise, with both energy torpedoes and twin main guns, along with several ball turret lasers. Asking question after question, he eventually fell asleep watching a video-like presentation on the intricacies of food preparation and production. Now Leo climbed out of bed and opened what would have once been his roommate's closet and walked into a bathroom. Chapter 3. Sitting down in his chair, Leo went through his bag one more time, checking to make sure that the picture with the frame of his family was wrapped up in case it got bumped. It wouldn't get broken. His Bible, which his parents had given him when he was confirmed, was next to the picture. He hadn't read it that much, but they had written some nice things in the cover, and he wanted to keep it around. Then there was his college sweatshirt and his Pittsburgh Steelers jersey, Jack Lambert's number. Then in the exterior pockets he had put his toothbrush and other hygiene items. Bang, bang. Leo jumped in his seat, then looked at the door. The knob twisted slowly, and then started to push in. "Captain Grant?" a deep voice called out. Leo didn't know what to say. "Leo Grant," the voice came again. "That's me," Leo responded this time, but still sitting down. A hand showed around the door, and then the top of someone's head slightly above the door handle. Then the rest of the head popped into view. Leo's initial thought was that a child had opened the door. After a slower look, Leo recognized that the man was a midget, or maybe the term was dwarf. "Captain Grant, you aren't going to throw anything or take a poke at me, are you?" the man said haltingly. "No, I'm not. Should I?" Leo responded. "No, not at all. It's just that I've already had one of your peers throw a stack of books at me, and one ambushed me as I walked into his room and wrestled me to the ground, until Captain de Clooney grabbed him off of me." "Well, I won't do anything like that, so please come on in," Leo said, gesturing from his chair. The small man opened the door and walked into the room. He was about 4 feet tall, short brown hair and brown eyes, and was wearing a plain black outfit with black boots. He walked across the room and extended his hand. "My name is Farlow, Jonathan Farlow, senior lieutenant," the last part he said hesitantly. Leo stood now and shook his hand. "Leo, Leo Grant." After retracting his hand, the man pulled out what looked to be a handheld computer. "Glad to meet you, Leo. Oh, and by the way," and after touching the computer screen, he looked up, "you are now a captain, junior grade. That means you outrank me." "Huh, how about that?" Leo said, surprised. "But if you'd follow me, our commanding officer, senior Captain de Clooney, would like to meet you now." Leo looked around the room one more time, trying to remember if he had forgotten anything. Deciding he hadn't, he picked up his bag. "Okay, I'm ready to go." The small man turned around and opened the door. Leo followed a step or two behind. They worked their way down a short hallway that was gray in color and lit every few feet with recessed lighting. Leo felt a wall at one point and noticed his very smooth, rock-type surface was dry and cold. They came to the end of the hallway and entered a much larger area that looked like a tunnel that could easily have fit a half a dozen or so tractor-trailer trucks side by side. Leo looked left and right and saw nothing but tunnel. Following Farlow, he looked ahead to the direction they were moving. About 100 yards down the tunnel, he could see a group of people around what seemed to be a vehicle. As they crossed the distance, Leo could see that there was actually several groups of three or four people talking. Standing on a vehicle, all alone, was a very thin man, dressed all in black like Farlow, working at a handheld computer intently. As they got closer, talking in the group ceased, and everyone turned to look at Leo and the midget. Leo looked over the groups. They were made up of men, no women present, all of them dressed in different styles and fashion. In fact, one man looked like he was wearing a kilt, another wore a three-piece suit, another a woolly fur cap, cloth parka draped over his arm. Leo saw this all as he steadily followed Farlow closer to the vehicle. Then he did a double take on the vehicle. It didn't have any wheels. When he initially saw it, he had assumed it had wheels. Now he saw it was hovering about 6 inches off the ground. He didn't have any more time to look at the vehicle because Farlow stopped a few paces away from the vehicle and waited. Leo stopped behind him and looked at the man who was still intently looking at his computer screen. He was tall, easily 6 feet tall, late 20s, jet black hair combed back from his face and thin, but Leo could tell the man was muscular. The man suddenly hit a button on the computer and turned to face them. "Any problems, Lieutenant Farlow?" the man said, looking down at the midget. "No, sir. This is Captain Grant," the smaller man said, gesturing towards Leo. The tall man stepped down from the vehicle and walked over to Leo and looked him over. Leo had never been in the military, but he kind of thought this was what it would like to be inspected. "Captain Leo David Grant, civilian, no military experience, age 20 years, citizenship, United States. Taken from Earth October 20th, 1987. Formerly a student of criminology and psychology," the man said, coming to a standstill in front of Leo. "Ah, that's right. Can I ask who you are?" Leo said, starting to feel a little uncomfortable around this man. The man smiled, which made Leo even more uncomfortable. "Senior Captain De Clooney, formerly of the French Foreign Legion, formerly holding the rank of Sergeant. Age 28, citizenship French, taken from Earth July 28th, 1959, the man said, extending his hand. Leo took it and realized his initial assessment that the man was muscular had been correct. "Welcome to Sanctuary, Captain Grant, and also to the year 2150. "Sanctuary?" "Yes, that is the name of the planet you were on." Leo felt really dumb. He had 1,000 questions, but no idea where to start, so he responded as best he could. "Uh-huh. Well, Captain Grant, if you would be so patient until Lieutenant Farlow retrieves 3 more of your peers, we will then have a briefing, and perhaps some more of your questions will be answered. If you would excuse us, please." Leo got the hint and turned and walked a few feet away from the only two people he knew on the planet. Not knowing what else to do, he did what came naturally. He joined a herd. Walking over to a group, he began to listen in. The group was a mixed bunch. An Asian guy dressed similarly to Leo in a red t-shirt and blue jeans. Another in what appeared to be a suit, but in a cut Leo wasn't familiar with. With one guy in sort of a brown, rough-cut outfit that was made up of a baggy, ill-shaped shirt and a pair of pants that were too long in one leg and shorter on the other leg. The group noticed Leo and immediately acknowledged him by opening up their circle a little bit. "Hi." The group just nodded back at him. Leo could sense some tension and was immediately sorry he picked this group to walk into. "Sorry for the cold shoulder, friend. You just walked in on us while with the discussion we were having was at an impasse," the guy in the strange suit stated, extending his hand. "Oh, what was the discussion about?" Leo asked, immediately hoping he wasn't being too nosy. "Well, our friend here was born in England, 1252, motioning towards the man in brown. He seems to think he is bewitched, or he is in hell, and we are trying to explain to him otherwise."
Chapter 4.
"The stars are very beautiful, are they not, my friend?" Leo turned around. It was Charles the Frenchman from 1863. "Yeah, but I don't recognize any of the constellations. I used to look up at the night sky and find Orion, with Ursa Major and Minor, and a few others, but now I don't see anything I recognize." "Yes, but I do see Trianus, Cretani, Hutta, and a few other stars," Charles replied, sitting down on the grass beside Leo. "I recognize those too, but they don't really mean that much to me. I mean, sure, I know their names, but I don't know if there are any myths or stories to go with them." "True enough, my American friend. But soon, if what De Clooney states is true, all this will become very meaningful," Charles said, not really sounding as if he believed it either. Leo sighed, and then yawned. It had been a very long day. After leaving his dorm room, which was really just a complex but exact holographic image of his room, then being introduced to his commanding officer, Captain De Clooney, then slowly meeting the other captains in his reconnaissance unit. They had been brought out of the tunnel by the hovercraft to this area, which from what Leo could see was miles and miles and miles of grassy fields, with occasional hills and valleys and small streams. They had set up a camp area, really just a few tables and some sleeping mats and bags. Then they had gotten down to one long session of question and answers. The initial briefing was provided by Captain de Clooney, who stood at the front of the area, while Leo and his peers had sat on the picnic tables listening. They'd recap what Leo had learned the previous day. They were on a planet halfway across the universe from Earth. An alien group called the Horde was probably going to discover Earth in the next 2 years, and if they acted according to their own history and tradition, they'd probably enslave Earth within 3 years. Then he gave a lecture on the additional education that had been placed in their brains. Knowledge about space travel, the high mathematics needed to comprehend the way hyperspace worked, repair skills so they could fix the spaceship they were assigned to, and language skills. That was when Leo realized all the talk he had been doing and all the reading he had been doing. For that matter, all the thinking he had been doing since waking up had been in the Larian Common, the language of the Horde. Captain de Clooney explained that while he had been asleep, the outfitters had taught information directly into their brains. His explanation was that the knowledge was like bubbles of air coming up through water. When the knowledge was called upon or needed, parts of it would rise to the conscious part of their brains and could be used. He further explained that the entire next year would be one of training and exercises so they could become confident in their new skills and knowledge. Then a briefing was given by Lieutenant Farlow on the plans for the next day. First, each captain would be issued a hovercraft and report to a ship and activate the general purpose droid assigned to that ship. After that was completed, they would greet each of their officers and then their assigned enlisted personnel, and then await further instructions from Captain de Clooney. During these briefings, hands would be raised by different people with questions, which took time to be answered. Then Farlow and de Clooney would try to get back to their initial point of the lecture. By the time both of them were finished, it was beginning to get dark, and the smell of food was coming from the far side of the camp area. De Clooney dismissed the men and directed them to get some food. The dinner consisted of large bowls of hot, thick, steamy beef stew, accompanied by large pieces of bread with generous portions of butter, and to wash it all down, some large glasses of either cold milk or cold ice water. When the meal was over, it was almost pitch black. De Clooney lit a fire in the small circle that the picnic table surrounded. Leo and the others were drawn to the fire and took up positions around it. De Clooney finally sat down as well after walking off with Farlow for 10 minutes. When De Clooney finally found a place at the fire, it was a good 10 minutes before a question was asked. Then the whole Q&A period started again. Leo was amazed at how much De Clooney knew. Every time he was asked, he either knew it or had an idea about the answer. Someone, Leo wasn't sure whom, because the person's face was masked in shadows, finally called de Clooney on it. "How do you know so much, de Clooney? Are you one of these so-called outfitters we have heard so much but so little about at the same time? Maybe this whole thing is just some sort of hoax. Why should we believe any of the stuff you are telling us?" Leo was sitting a few feet from de Clooney and immediately saw several changes in his facial expression. First anger, then just as quickly, exasperation, then finally resolve. De Clooney responded firmly and with a great deal of passion. "The reason I know so much is because I have been awake for 2 days already, asking these same questions in similar type briefings with my peers. Secondly, there is no way to prove to you who I say I am, a former sergeant from the French Foreign Legion." De Clooney now held up three fingers. "Thirdly, as for this being a hoax, well, it could be, but what an elaborate hoax it is, and I have been fooled by it as well. And finally, why should you believe any of this? I think it comes down to the basic question, what choice do you have? You could disbelieve and try to wake yourself from this dream. You could think that you are dead, and that this is heaven or hell, or you could choose to play along and hope that it comes out for the best." De Clooney stared at the fire for a few seconds, and no one spoke. "That is what I'm doing, playing along the best I know how, and hope, pray that everything works out for the best." This last part was said softly, but Leo was sure everyone heard it because the air was completely still. That was a half an hour ago. Now Leo was laying on his back, staring up at a strange bunch of stars, and talking to a guy that had been born about 100 years before his own birthday. They were talking in an alien language, the same aliens that would enslave Earth if this eclectic group of people could not pull it together. Chapter 5. Of the 14 other captains, Leo had not really gotten to know many of them. He'd only really talked to a few. He had been able to get on the good side of Clarence, the clergyman from 1252 England, the one who believed everyone was a demon. Leo had ended up next to him at breakfast this morning. The man was still grumbling about demons when Leo had an idea. Reaching into his backpack, which he had always kept close by, he pulled out his Bible and ripped out the 2 pages with his parents' notes. Leo then turned and offered it to him without a word. The man looked at it like a glass of water in the desert. He had flipped through the pages and read what looked to Leo like passages at random. Then, after flipping to the back cover, he bowed his head quickly, then looked up at Leo and smiled, and Leo thought he saw a tear in his eye. Clarence stood up quickly and said thanks softly and walked away to the top of a nearby hill and sat down to read. Leo watched him for a few minutes. It was then that he realized that somebody was staring at him. He turned and caught the gaze of De Clooney, who was standing across the table. De Clooney nodded approvingly. Leo responded with a small smile and a shrug. De Clooney then turned and walked away without a word. A few minutes later, the captains were dismissed, with strict orders to begin getting their crews working together and follow the training outlines. Each was given a hovercraft to take them to their ships. The wind felt good. He felt freer and better than he had since he had first come awake and found himself here. Maybe he felt so good because he was controlling this hovercraft, crossing the plains of this planet all by himself. He felt just like he did the first time his parents had let him take the family car out for the evening, like anything and everything was possible. But the scenery, the hills and the valleys of knee-deep green grass that he floated over reminded him that he wasn't on Earth, and if everything was true that he had heard, it might be a long time before he ever saw Earth again. The vehicle gave a small bump, and Leo noted he was now climbing a hill. As soon as the hovercraft reached the top of the hill, it slightly banked in what Leo guessed was a westward direction. At least it would have been on Earth. He started to get antsy, wondering how long it would take to get it to his ship. "How long till we reach my ship?" Leo asked the computer, which was running the autopilot program on the hovercraft. The mechanical voice came from the panel. 15 minutes, Captain Grant." Looking around again, he realized he was riding along top of a ridge, with both sides sloping gently away from him. Then Leo saw his first ship of the fleet. It was about 2 miles away on his right-hand side, and it was big. Leo got pretty excited. "Computer, is that my ship?" The response was immediate. "No, that is a fighter launcher ship of your squadron, with a crew of 415. "Oh," Leo said, disappointed. Leo thought about what the computer had just said. "Computer, what do you mean, of my squadron?" The craft replied quickly. "The fleet is divided into 5 squadrons. Each squadron has 1 fighter-launcher ship in it. It is designed to launch small, single-person fighters that move at great speeds and have greater maneuverability than larger-person crewed ships. This type of ship carries 100 such fighters." "Enough, computer. That answered my question," Leo stated quickly before the computer started rambling, which is what the computers tended to do, going into explicit and boring detail if they weren't stopped. "Sort of like an aircraft carrier for space," Leo thought. "It sort of looked like one." From where he was, he saw that the top of the ship was flat with a hangar-type opening at one end, probably a control top tower on top of the hangar, looking forward towards the point where the ships probably took off. What Leo couldn't figure out was how the ships landed back on the thing, because if it landed on the same deck they took off from, it caused quite a traffic jam. Leo looked at the ship a bit more before he realized that the back bottom of the ship was open, with what Leo deduced was a landing deck. Leo didn't know much about aircraft carriers, but this design seemed to make a lot of sense. Leo continued to look at the ship as the hovercraft moved along the top of the grassy ridge away from it. When Leo realized that he was turned completely around on the hovercraft, looking back at the ship. They had gone about 3 miles from where he'd first seen the ship. Leo pivoted back to the direction they were headed. The hovercraft was still headed west and was starting to come to the end of the ridge when Leo saw his ship. He knew it as soon as he saw it. He just knew it was his. It was sitting at the bottom of a bowl-shaped area about 6 miles in diameter. The ship was sitting in the exact center. Leo, seeing it in profile, could tell immediately that it was much smaller than the fighter launcher. This ship was only a few stories tall, whereas the fighter launcher was at least 20 stories from the ground to the top of the launch deck. No, Leo's ship was about 5 stories tall, but it looked lean and fast, sort of like the PT boats of World War II, he thought. The front part was a disc shape, with guns mounted at the topmost and lowest points on it. The tail end of the ship was spliced in the disc part and was longer and thinner than the disc. The tail looked to be about 2 or 3 stories thick, whereas the disc section appeared to be about 4 stories from the top to the bottom. The whole ship was about 10 to 15 meters off the ground, resting on its landing gear. The ship was a little under 100 meters long and solid light absorbing black in color, with occasional patches of gray where instruments, weapons, and portals protruded. Leo stopped and stared and took a breath. He loved the design, and it took his breath away knowing it was his. The hovercraft was beginning to slow down and announced, "Your ship, Captain Grant." Leo didn't say anything. He was trying to take it all in, from the landing gear to the oddly shaped fixtures along the surface of the ship. The hovercraft slowed to a stop, and Leo hopped out on the side closest to the ship with his bag slung over his shoulder. Leo was near the front of the ship, but not quite underneath it. Leo heard the hovercraft's engine revving and started to speed away, but he ignored it. Leo was still looking over the ship when some motion caught his eye. There, from the underside of the ship, a ramp was being lowered. Leo focused his attention on the ramp, wondering what was going to happen next. After the ramp was fully extended to the ground, a robot emerged. Leo knew it was a robot. He had seen them in the movies, and this is what they always look like. Walking erect, made of a dull blue metal with two arms and two legs. A face with flat features, a box-like chest, with smaller connecting boxes leading down to what on a human would be the pelvic region. Yep, Leo thought, a robot, and it was headed towards him. Captain Leo David Grant, the robot said, after stopping exactly 3 feet in front of Leo. That's me, Leo said, looking over the robot. What speech pattern would you like for me to emulate? Excuse me, Leo said with genuine confusion. I am now speaking with the standard voice pattern of all robots to be found within the fleet. Would you like to customize my speech pattern so that we could interface more easily? Sure, Leo said, not sure what direction this conversation was going. The choices are as various as those of your home planet Earth. Any speech pattern from any area on Earth is available, from any country or region, in any time frame in Earth's recorded history. Oh, I think I'm beginning to understand now. Leo pondered it for a moment, turned some possibilities over in his mind, then came to a decision. How about the characteristics of an American from the New England area, say about 35 years old, and the tone of a very interesting English professor? Sort of like Robin Williams in the Dead Poets Society. Very well, sir, the robot said, its voice changing immediately. I suppose that you would like my vocal emissions to retain the characteristics of the male of the species. Yes, that is exactly what I wanted, Leo said, quite pleased with himself. Now then, sir, would you like a tour of your ship? You have exactly 57 minutes until your first mate arrives, the robot said. No, not right now, although Leo really wanted to look inside the ship. What is your name? Leo said, looking at the robot. My name, sir? Why, I don't have a name. I would suppose that is for you and the crew to determine. Well, you've got to have a name so that when the rest of the crew meets you, I can introduce you. What is your function on the ship? My function on the ship is to be a guide, to help familiarize you and the crew with the functions of the ship, and once that is done, to assist the crew in whatever task is at hand. Leo looked at the robot a little more and thought of some characters from TV and movies with a New England type accent. Then he smiled. Your name is going to be Winchester, after a character on one of my favorite television shows. I am theorizing the name comes from the television show MASH, the character being Major Charles Emerson Winchester III. Yeah, how did you know that? I have complete files on all the ship's personnel. All I did was access your file and ran the name Winchester through my files to see if there was any connection. Leo was amazed, not only at the speed of the association, but that the robot, Winchester now, had his favorite television show in his personnel files. What else was in his files, he wondered. Winchester, what else do you have in my file? Well, Captain, I have all your records over your activities on Earth, basic physical, social, and psychological profile on you and all the members of the crew. Uh-huh, I see. Well, since you know so much about me, then tell me something about yourself. Where were you before being assigned to this fleet? I haven't been anywhere else. I was activated exactly 2 hours and 15 minutes ago at the top of the ramp. Since that time, I've been running self-diagnostic tests on myself and testing my communication systems by communicating with the ship and the other robots on the ship. I've also been testing my mechanical functions in regards to the specifications laid out in my memory. I see. Leo said, stroking his chin and looking back at the ship. Did you say you have been communicating with the ship and the other robots? What other robots, Winchester? The other robots on the ship, Captain Grant. 2 major repair and 4 minor repair robots are part of the ship's complement. So they're not like you, then? No, sir, Winchester said quickly and with a tone that sounded a bit aloof. Winchester continued. They are programmed to assist in repairs of the ship and have very little personality, unlike myself, who is programmed for the maximum amount of personal interaction. Winchester, I do believe you are a bit of a snob, Leo noted, amused. You are pretty stuck up for not even being 3 hours old yet. Well, Captain, you did name me and set my basic personality by selecting my name and voice. Next time, tell me what the ramifications will be before I go selecting any more voice patterns. Why, certainly, Captain. Now then, Winchester, my good robot, why don't you walk me around the outside of the ship? Very well, sir. Leo was still looking at the ship with a great deal of awe and started to look at it with even closer scrutiny. The first thing he examined was the gun mounted on the lowest part of the disc. It was mounted to swivel in all directions and tilt up and down. The gun itself consisted of 2 barrels with what looked like a large silencer on the end of both barrels. As he touched it, a rush of knowledge came to him. He knew that to disassemble it, you would need a fitted wrench with a non-magnetized jaw. Leo shook his head. This information rush was something that took getting used to. As Leo examined the exterior of the ship, he investigated a lot of things that he did not understand or even know what they were. But the information rose to his conscious mind easily, and it became less and less startling. All along the way, Winchester was right beside him. Well, actually, the robot stood slightly to his left and slightly behind. He explained that this was a traditional spot when accompanying a superior officer, and he was fully programmed in all military protocol. Winchester remained quiet until Leo would ask him a question. Then he would answer a modest explanation of the name of the mechanism and its function. This would in turn bring more information up from deep within Leo's brain. After looking over the ship for about 20 minutes, Leo had wound up at the tail of the ship. Leo was amazed. The ship, it was incredible, and this was just the outside. He could not wait to get inside.
Chapter 6. The awakening was complete. The outfitters would know if their mission was a success. This species would begin making their choices soon. Then the outfitters would leave this system and continue their voyage home. Chapter 7. Leo took another long swig from his frosty mug of beer. He really needed it, and it looked like it was going to be a long, interesting voyage back to Earth, to say the least. It had been a long day after meeting the crew, and then looking over the rest of the ship, and then stopping a fight, and finally figuring out where to get food, and then bunk assignments. Leo was exhausted. The most interesting part of the day, though, had been meeting the crew. So far, Leo was happy with those people assigned to him. Well, almost everybody. He was glad to have the first mate he had been assigned. After touring the exterior of the ship, Leo had returned to the ramp. It was then that another hovercraft approached. "Your first mate, sir," Winchester announced. "What's his name, Winchester?" Leo said quickly, not turning his head but following the hovercraft. "His name is Yoshida Burgai," Winchester stated. "Huh?" he said out of the corner of his mouth, while tracking the approaching vehicle still. "I do not understand the question." "Never mind, Winchester," Leo said. The hovercraft was almost there, and there was no time to question Winchester about the first mate. The hovercraft stopped, and Leo watched a tall, dark-haired Asian guy get out. Leo looked at him, and the stranger looked back. Leo smiled, hoping to put the guy at ease. The guy was dressed in blue jeans and a red polo shirt, and carried a large gym bag in one hand, and another large bag slung across his back. As he approached, his face turned to a more serious look. He stopped a few feet from Leo and put his bags down. "Hi, my name is Leo. Leo Grant," he said, extending his hand. "Captain Grant, I assume?" the guy asked with a hint of a strange accent while shaking Leo's hand. "That's right, but you can call me Leo. And what can I call you?" "Lieutenant, Junior Grade, Yoshida Burgai, reporting for duty, sir." The guy seemed kind of cold, so Leo decided to break the ice as fast as possible. "Hey, listen up. You and I are probably about the same age. We are going to be together for a while, so let's keep it informal, shall we?" "Okay," and the man's face lost its very serious look and blended into a less serious mask. "I just want to get off on a good foot, and I figured we should start formally, then figure out where to go from there. But I can see this is going to be very entertaining," the guy said with an obvious look of relief on his face that turned into a smile after Leo chuckled. Leo smiled back. "Where are you from?" "Well, that is a story. I was born in Germany, but my mother was Japanese and my father was Swiss. I have dual citizenship in both countries, although I'm attending college in the States about 200 years ago." "Oh, really? What college?" "I was attending MIT, studying architecture and mathematics." "Oh," said Leo, somewhat intimidated. "How about you? What were you doing before you got stuck way out here?" "I was attending a small college in Pennsylvania, studying criminology and psychology." "What year did you get sucked out of?" "I was a freshman, 1972. "Oh, really? I was a sophomore, 1988. "And who is this?" Yoshida said, looking over Winchester with a great deal of interest. "My name is Winchester, Lieutenant Burgai, general purpose robot for this ship." "Well, Captain, what are your orders?" the newcomer asked, looking over Winchester intently while circling him. "Well, Yoshida," Leo said with a grin, "I have not been inside the ship yet, so would you like to join me on a tour to see what we can see?" The Asian man nodded slowly while still staring at Winchester and coming to a stop next to Leo again. Leo turned to Winchester. "Winchester, my good man, the 50-cent tour of the interior of the ship, if you please." "Very good, Captain." The droid turned and led Leo up the ramp. Yoshida dropped his bags at the base of the ramp near Leo and followed him into the ship. That was the beginning. He had discovered that the main section was the disc, which separated into four levels, the first level being the major equipment storage area containing pressure suits for working in a vacuum and equipment of all kinds. The next level contained much of the ship's instrumentation, which left very little room to walk through. The next level was the crew's living quarters, with two people per room, except Leo, who had a room of his own, and a large eating/meeting area centrally located. The fourth and topmost level is where the bridge was located, as well as a workout area, another small dining area, and several small research stations, all located directly behind and below the bridge section. Slightly behind and above the bridge section was a large turret-mounted blaster. The rear section of the ship was made up of three levels, the majority of which was taken up by the hyperdrive engines. There were also two surprises here, two fighter craft, which Leo had no idea were there. One exited through the top portion of the ship, the other through the bottom half. Both were one-person, long-range fighter ships, which were launched from the ship for attack, reconnaissance, or defense. Winchester's tour touched briefly on some of the major features of the ship. Leo was slowly overwhelmed by all the information. As they were going along, new members of the crew would show up and introduce themselves in a variety of ways. The first to show up after Yoshida were William Packer, a frontiersman from 1767, who Leo later learned went to sleep in the wilderness of Kentucky and woke up in the replica of a colonial inn, where he is met by a holographic projection of Benjamin Franklin, who spent the night explaining the situation to him. The other was an Irishman, who didn't say much, except that his name was Logan Mansfield, and that he used to be a blacksmith. Leo liked Packer immediately. He was friendly, wore a continuous smile, and extended his hand warmly, whereas Mansfield stood off to the side with his arms crossed and a serious look on his face. They followed along with the tour until they arrived in the flight bay, where Winchester announced they would be the pilots of the two ships. They stated they wanted to examine their ships, so Yoshida and Leo proceeded with the tour. The next stop was the engineering section, where two more personnel showed up. The first was a tank driver from the Israeli Army, 1989. The other was a taxi cab driver from Busan, Korea, 1963. Their names were Abraham Gutenberg and Kim Y. Moon, respectively. They were the co-pilot and communications officers, but Leo did not catch which was which. Leo had already figured out that Yoshida was the pilot. What exactly Leo did, besides being the captain, was not entirely clear. As Leo and Yoshida wandered back through the ship to look things over slowly, Winchester was sent ahead to greet more of the crew members. Walking along the main corridor of the ship, they were met by another member of their crew, Fiagata Tutela, the chief engineer, and easily the biggest guy Leo had ever seen in person. The guy was easily 6'4" and about 300 pounds, and his hands were as big as Leo's head. "How's it?" the large man said. "Pardon me?" said Leo. "How's it, Holly?" "Excuse me," Yoshida said. "Which way to my engine room? I am to be the head engineer of this ship, so where is my office?" "Back there," Leo said, motioning back down the hallway they had just come from. "Mahalo. By the way, the name's Fia Tutelli." They didn't speak until the big guy had wedged past them. "What the hell was that?" Yoshida asked. "That was a very big man and our chief engineer, I guess," Leo said, watching the giant go down the hallway. "Wow," said Yoshida, as they walked back towards the front part of the ship. When they got back to the front part of the ship, they heard some raised voices coming from the third level. Leo and Yoshida exchanged glances and hurried up the ladder to the living area. What greeted them was a nice little fight going on between the pilot, Logan Mansfield, and a crew member that Leo hadn't met yet. They were standing in the middle of the deck, trading slug for slug. Pack and the others were just standing around, not sure what to do. With a nod to Yoshida, Leo grabbed the other crew member, and Yoshida grabbed Logan. "Stop it right now," Leo yelled. As the two men struggled to break free, Logan said, "It's all right, Captain. I'm finished." Leo spun the other crew member around, looked him in the eye, and said, "Well, I'm finished for now, but tell him not to mess with me again. I don't care what was said or what was done. There will be no fighting on this ship. If you want to fight, go outside. But when you do come back inside, things had better be resolved, and you had better be acting like adults." The two men shrugged themselves away from their restrainers and moved to opposite ends of the crowd that had gathered in the large dining room. Everyone was looking at him. Leo was a bit surprised with himself, probably more surprised than anyone else in the room. Leo was getting a little self-conscious and didn't know what to do, so he did the first thing that came to his mind. "Anyone else hungry? I am starved," he asked in a voice almost as loud as when he had been yelling at the guys. Yoshida backed him up. "I know that I am. Winchester, where do we get food around here?" The robot took a step forward from the wall where he had been standing. "Well, sir, in those two slots to the rear of those gentlemen over there," Winchester motioned to Packer and another new crew member, "are the food service slots. To activate them, speak clearly into the computer panel, saying what would you like to eat. The computer has stored in its memory over 2 million dishes served on Earth. You can learn others and tailor the dishes to your individual tastes." "Winchester, why don't you demonstrate the service to us?" Leo said, trying to move the thing along. A thought sprung into Leo's head. He already knew how to use the service, what buttons to push and all. He even knew that the food was actually reconstituted molecules, either from waste material on the ship or from collected gases in storage, mostly hydrogen, and then realigned by the computer to whatever they needed. Leo shook his head, more of that unconscious knowledge coming to the surface. The crew gathered around Winchester as he demonstrated the service. Leo watched with some interest, but he was busy trying to get his body to calm down after the outburst and the rush of adrenaline he had just experienced just a few minutes before. He had taken charge. He didn't know why he had. It had surprised him. He had never really been in charge of anything before. Sure, he had organized things like camping trips and caving trips among his friends back home, but he had never really been in charge. When he looked up again, he realized that Yoshida was getting a meal out of the server for himself. A hamburger, fries, and a Coca-Cola. Leo got up to the machine and asked for a grilled cheese, potato chips, and a glass of iced tea. When the food came out, Leo grabbed it and looked around for a seat. The large table had a few seats empty, so he sat down next to Yoshida. Everyone sort of looked up from their food when he sat down, expecting him to say something. Leo looked around, trying to be nonchalant. Well, how's the grub?
Okay, a little bland, but passable, said Abraham Gutenberg, the tanker.
Leo took a bite. I see what you mean.
He saw Winchester standing a few feet away.
Winchester, how do we spice up these meals? Maybe add salt or something?
Well, that is quite simple. Just speak into the panel as though you were ordering your food and ask for more spice or less, depending on your taste.
Sounds simple enough, Kim said from across the table.
No one said anything, and a bit of silence gripped the table as well as the rest of the room. The only sound to be heard was the sound of plates and cups moving.
Everyone finished eating, and then Winchester showed them where to put the dishes. The crew stood around, and the uncertainty was almost tangible. Packer yawned and stretched and excused himself, then climbed down the ladder towards the outside. Leo decided to take charge at that point.
Winchester, would you show everyone where their bunks are?
If everyone would follow me, I will show you who is assigned to what quarters, starting with Lieutenant Gutenberg and Lieutenant Moon.
Leo got up and climbed down the ladder. He found the ramp leading to the outside and walked down it. The sun was just beginning to go down in the west, and there was a chill in the air, along with the feel of oncoming dew.
Leo walked out from underneath the ship and saw Packer standing looking towards the setting sun. Leo walked towards him and stopped when he was standing beside him.
Nice sunset, eh? Leo said.
Yeah, said Packer. Don't know what to think of all this, do you?
Well, to tell you the truth, neither do I, Leo said, trying to sound friendly.
You think it's hard for you to believe, Packer said, turning and motioning towards the ship. When I went to sleep a few nights ago, the biggest piece of machinery I had ever seen was a watermill used to grind flour, and the most complex thing was a grandfather clock. Then I woke up now and I see machines that fly, people that I've never seen before, and metal boxes that talk. You know, before this I barely knew my alphabet. On top of that, I'm told that my home planet is threatened by a bunch of monsters and demons, and I've been asked to defend against them.
What to think?
I have no idea what to think, except maybe that this is a dream, but even I couldn't dream this much.
Leo just nodded. He couldn't add anything to that. In fact, it just about summed up everything. He just stood there a while longer, trying to figure out what to do next.
The sun was down when Leo and Packer turned and started walking back towards the ship. At the bottom of the ship, the rest of the crew sat and stood around the ramp, Yoshida being out in front of them, with Winchester at his side. They didn't look organized, just sort of lost and unsure what to do. Leo noticed that Logan and the other crew member who he had been fighting with were still standing on opposite sides of the crowds from one another. Leo and Packer walked up and stopped.
What's up, Yoshi? Leo asked, trying to sound upbeat.
Well, I came down to get my bags, and the rest of the guys just sort of followed. Not sure what to do.
Oh, I see. Leo turned to face the crew and tried to sound like a commander.
Well, everybody, I'm not sure what to do either, but let's all get back to our rooms and try to get a good night's sleep. I hope there will be a definite plan in the morning of what is going to happen. Maybe we'll get some direction from the rest of the fleet. But until then, I really don't have much to say, except I know I'll get to know you all better tomorrow. With that said, some of the guys started to wander up the ramp. Others grabbed their bags from the grass surrounding the ramp and followed up. Packer thumped Leo in the back as he went up the ramp. Leo was leaning against the ramp supports when Yoshida joined him, with Winchester standing below them.
Winchester, what is the plan from here? Leo asked.
Sir, there is no plan, but I assume your commanding officer will be contacting you tomorrow. And if I may suggest, you may want to begin fully activating the ship first thing tomorrow morning.
What do you mean, activating the ship? Yoshi asked.
Well, sir, the main computer ship has not been fully brought online to fully identify and work with the crew. In fact, only the major systems on the ship have been activated. Life support, replicators, and communications. The captain, first mate, co-pilot, chief engineer, and communications officer all have to be at their assigned workstations to fully activate all the command functions in order for the ship to become fully sentient.
Wait a second, Winchester. You said earlier you were talking with the ship. Didn't that mean that the ship was up and running?
No, sir. I said I was doing basic communications check of the ship. I was determining if our relay links were working by sending back and forth large series of numbers and equations, then seeing if we each sent back and forth the proper series. Other than that, there had been no meaningful communications between us. Leo exhaled with a bit of frustration and decided to continue with the mysterious process.
"What do we have to do to get the ship up and running?" Leo asked, feeling exhausted.
"Well, sir, you each have to be at your assigned workstations, as I stated earlier. Then you will have to undergo a scan of DNA, fingerprints, retina, and brainwaves. Then each of you will have to enter a personal identification code of your own choosing. Then you will have to activate the energy flows for each section of the ship to allow it to become fully responsive and aware of its surroundings. After approximately 15 minutes, the ship will choose a voice and speech pattern that will best suit the temperament of the crew. The ship will then begin to tutor each individual on their functions in the ship."
"You mean we don't get to choose the speech pattern like I did for you?" Leo asked, a bit surprised.
"No, sir. In the design of a positronic brain, the larger the ship, the more self-determination that ship has. While on the flagship of the fleet, the positronic brain might be considered a total person, with feelings and attitudes from the moment it is turned on."
"You mean our ship has no personality?" Yoshida asked.
"Not right away, but over time, the ship will develop one depending on its level of interaction with the crew."
Leo thought about this for a moment. "Wow, what a concept, a ship with a personality. Kind of scary in most science fiction stories he had read. It was not always a great thing for a ship to be sentient.
Yoshida, I definitely think we should wait until tomorrow to do this startup."
Yoshida appeared to be lost in thought and just nodded his head.
Leo headed up the ramp, followed by Yoshida and Winchester. When Leo got back up to the crew deck, he went up to the server and got a beer and sat down. There were others there as well, and not much was said. An end to a very long day, and they did not look like they were going to get any easier. But hey, one day at a time, he thought, as he hefted up his now empty mug, put it at his disposal before looking for his cabin.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Scouts Out by A.A. Foringer, as read by the author. This audio production, copyright 2015, all rights reserved. A new episode of Scouts Out is released every Saturday. To get an ebook version of this story, go to smashwords.com, where you can find other stories in the Outfitters universe. The story you have just listened to may contain slight variations from the original text due to translation from written word to spoken word, but overall, the story has not been changed. To contact Aaron, visit his blog at aaforinger.com or email him at aaforinger@gmail.com. He is also on Twitter as aaforinger. He craves your feedback, so get to the comm link of your choice and commence with the typing.